you have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
From the Moen Broadcast Center, this is Take Two. Me, Martinez. A federal judge orders the city and county of LA to offer some form of shelter to every single unhoused person of Skid Row by October. We'll hear from Councilman Kevin DeLeon on what this could mean for his district. Plus, Pacoima is surrounded by freeways, gravel pits, and recycle centers, which makes its air quality awful. Find out how it got that way. It's all ahead on Take Two.
Imagine if you could charge your electric vehicle at the places you already love to eat, shop, and play. Whether you're at the movies, on your weekly grocery trip, or running errands at your local mall, Volta EV charging stations are built around your day-to-day and located in your community and nationwide. All you have to do is check in, plug in, and go about your day. It's EV charging made convenient. Download the Volta app to find your new favorite place to charge.
From 89.3 KPCC and KPCC.org, this is Take Two. I'm Martinez. Thanks for joining us. Coming up.
It became this really fascinating, eclectic neighborhood of African-Americans, Mexican-Americans, and Japanese-Americans, too.
The history of Pacoima, one of the oldest neighborhoods in the northeast San Fernando Valley, and also one of the most disadvantaged in terms of pollution. That's coming up just ahead. But first, to some big news this week. The city of Los Angeles on Monday proposed spending $1 billion on homeless services and prevention. But that isn't enough for federal judge David O'Carter, who's presiding over a lawsuit against LA City and the county for failing to get people off the streets. On Tuesday, Carter ordered the county and the city to offer some sort of shelter to those experiencing homelessness in downtown Skid Row by mid-October. And I mean every single person. LA City Councilmember Kevin DeLeon represents Skid Row and has proposed his own plan to support the unsheltered. Councilman, welcome back.
Oh, thank you so much. Hey, great to be back.
Now, it seems that Judge Carter is lowering the hammer on this issue. Now, before we get into all the specifics, what was your immediate response to this?
I was surprised. There's no question about it. I didn't see it coming, but I got to stand up and applaud the judge. He wants urgency. He wants immediacy, and he's lighting a fire under the city.
Now, I think my read on this, Councilman, is that he thinks LA has focused too much on permanent housing solutions that are difficult to get built a lot of the times as more and more people make camp on the streets. So now he wants people put somewhere, even if it's only temporary. How doable is that in Skid Row?
Well, listen, I think you can do both. I think you can provide, you know, permanent housing solutions, which are more mid to long term. At the same time, you can provide the immediate urgent shelter that they need. Listen, we have folks who are dying on the streets every single day in Los Angeles. Just last year alone, we had over 1,300 human beings who lost their lives. They succumbed to either, you know, illnesses or just being exposed to the elements. I don't think they're exclusive of each other. I think they're compatible with each other.
I'm surprised to hear you say that, Councilman, because I think sometimes, yeah, it's aspirational to want to strive for both, but it seems as if picking one or the other is the only way to get either one even close to being done.
I think it's, I've always found it very odd that in the city of LA, the culture has been, you have to live in a world of absolutes. You choose one or the other. They're compatible with each other. You can provide the short-term housing, the temporary shelter, non-congregate that's needed to provide them a shelter, a safe place, so they're not sexually assaulted, so they're not robbed, so they're not physically violated. At the same time, we should focus our resources, the majority of our resources, in a very efficient a manner, which is to provide the housing, whether it's prefabricated modular housing or whether it is scattered site master leasing. We have tens of thousands of vacancies, not just in the city of LA, but throughout the region in the county of Los Angeles. I know there's a lot of landlords who would love to have a guaranteed stream of revenue to house those who need a roof over their head.
So what has been then the biggest obstacle to achieving both, or at least making progress toward achieving both?
I think there's a deep culture of bureaucracy within the city of Los Angeles that moves at a snail's pace. It's going to take a fire that's lit underneath them to make sure that they move with a sense of urgency, whether it's at the end of the day, this becomes a consent decree, or even worse, it becomes a takeover, if you will, by a U.S. federal judge who, in effect, becomes a sort of shadow governance structure of the elected representatives of the city of LA. That's the worst case scenario, a receivership. But nonetheless, I think that this will light a fire. Now, this may sound a little odd, perhaps, but I think that this is actually a golden opportunity. I think a lot of folks are overreacting, sort of kind of like the sky is falling with the judge's edict, mm-hmm. his order that he articulated yesterday in written form. But I think it provides us a golden opportunity to really sit down and negotiate with the judge, as well as the plaintiffs of the LA Alliance lawsuit, and find a long-term global solution to deal with the 41,000 men and women and children who are living on our streets, our parkways, our alleyways, in their cars and RVs every single night in Los Angeles.
Now, when you say negotiate, Councilman De Leon, what does that mean? Because here's the thing. We know that he wants this all done by mid-October, but what I don't think is clear, at least to me, is the what happens if that doesn't happen. So what's your understanding on what happens if this doesn't get accomplished to the judge's satisfaction by mid-October?
Well, I don't think the dust has settled yet, so I don't think we know precisely with a sense of accuracy. What will happen? Will we be held in contempt of court? Will we be put in jail? Will there be financial, monetary penalties that will hurt the city of LA? We don't know that yet. But like I said, I want to go back to this is a golden opportunity to sit down with the judge as well as the plaintiffs and negotiate a global solution, understanding that uplifting or uprooting 5,000, more than 5,000 individuals just in Skid Row alone, and actually finding the resources necessary within a handful of months is going to be next to impossible, short of any major intervention from both the state and federal government to provide the resources that are necessary to take on such a gargantuan, massive operation. That being said, it's a shot across the bow by U.S. federal judge David Carter in this instance, who I think is sick and tired of false promises, of continued negotiations that end up nowhere. And quite frankly, with a culture that likes to study everything to death, now's the time for action. Now's the time to prove to the federal judge, and more importantly, to our unhoused community neighbors, as well as the voters, the residents of the city of LA and the county of LA, that we mean action and we're going to do what we say. And moreover, I want to add to this, we need the county of Los Angeles to step up. The motion for dismissal with the LA Alliance lawsuit is demonstrating an abdication of responsibility. We have so many individuals who are severely mentally ill, who are running down the street half naked, who are speaking to themselves. They need intervention. They need our help. And I think right now the LA County, governance is just not stepping up to do what's necessary to take care of those who need the help the most.
We're talking with LA City Councilmember Kevin De Leon. Now, just to be clear to anyone that's listening, you just joined the city council not that long ago. So when we talk about the bureaucracy, this is something that you're at least new to on the city level. But what kind of bureaucratic stickiness have you encountered when it comes to homelessness in your district?
Well, I can tell you this. One of the ideas I have is we know that real estate valuation is at a premium in the city of LA. And why compete with the market when it's going to cost taxpayers so much more money? Why don't we utilize city land and build on city land for our unhoused community members? It'd be a lot less expensive. We eliminate, real estate costs and we build with the portfolio assets that we currently own. But that being said, we've submitted, motions to get a whole portfolio or a whole list of inventory. And there's a sort of a slow walk, if you will. I understand that folks are empire building or folks want to protect turf. It's all understandable. It's part of the human psychology. It doesn't make a difference if it's the city of LA, the state government, or the federal government. But this is a magnitude. This is a crisis of a magnitude unlike anything we've ever experienced before. That means it's all hands on deck, and we cannot allow bureaucrats and the culture of bureaucracy to slow the wheels of progress.
Now, when it comes to city-owned properties, I know Judge Carter ordered that the city hold on to 14,000 city-owned properties. You have your own proposal to build 25,000 units by 2025, and that's your 25 by 25 plan. Considering this move, Councilman, by Judge Carter, are you rethinking your plan?
Well, actually, no. Listen, this is the reason why back in January I released A Way Home. It's a comprehensive plan to house, you know, and create 25,000 units by the year 2025. What we're missing here are tangible goals and benchmarks. That's why my plan provides a North Star. The problem of homelessness has been lacked accountability. If you have a North Star, and I get it, you know, politicians across the spectrum are loath to give a figure, a number, for fear of falling woefully short. Even if we were to fall short and made great strides, it only gives us information on what we need to modify and edit to meet our overall goal. So actually, I'm doubling down on my Way Home plan. And I think that, interestingly, without having any conversations with Judge Carter since, you know, his order, that there's elements of A Way Home that are part of his order as well.
Now, going back really quick, Councilman, to the comment you made about half-naked people who need help, I'm curious what you mean when you say by means of intervention, because that's not the majority of the people that are dealing with the situation in Skid Row. So I'm wondering what you mean by intervention on that case.
No, I mean, the majority of folks who right now find themselves unhoused are folks who are there because of economic insecurity, because of bad luck. We have other individuals who are dealing with severe mental illnesses or they're dealing with drug addictions. And then you have a small number of individuals who are severely mentally ill, and they need our intervention. That's what government is for. And the city of LA does not have a Department of Mental Health. The county of Los Angeles has a Department of Mental Health. They need beds to make sure that they can house these individuals who need that psychological, psychiatric help. That's the narrative. When we think about homeless individuals, that's a large narrative that is in the part of our conscientious mindset. But, you know, we need the county, Department of Mental Health, to really step up and intervene and provide those individuals who are suffering from really deep, severe psychotic, you know, episodes, a sanctuary, a place that they can call home where they can get the help that they need.
Now, about the mayor's budget proposals announced this week, $1 billion for homelessness, not yet in hand, though, I don't think. But Councilman, where is that money expected to come from?
Well, it's not in hand yet, but I'm going to give kudos to Mayor Eric Garcetti. It's a gargantuan sum of money that he's ponying up. He's committing to it. We look forward to reviewing it in the budget committee, which I'm a member of. Parts of that money do come from the federal government. It comes from Joe Biden's package that rescue to many cities and states throughout the country. So the money is on the way, without question. We don't have it in our accounts right now, but I think we can bank on it. We can count on it. And I got to give the mayor a lot of credit. He's stepping up.
Is that the same $1 billion that Judge Carter has asked to be put in an escrow account? Is that the same thing that we're talking about?
That we're not sure about. If I were to sort of take a guess, I would, you know, based on my own conjecture, I would believe that the judge is talking about the same amount of money. And that's why we have to have a little more communication with Judge Dave Carter to identify which resources that he's looking at. Because we may be talking about the same dollars, or maybe he's talking about some different dollars, you know. But, you know, we're looking at a substantial amount of money that we should be using every single dollar, every single penny to put a roof over their head. When it comes to homelessness services, that is the responsibility of the county of Los Angeles. We need to collaborate. We need to cooperate. We need to step up together. This is all hands on deck. That means if it doesn't make a difference if you're a member of Congress, if you're a member of the state legislature, if you're a county board supervisor, mayor, or council member, the unhoused neighbors that we have living in our communities today are everyone's constituent. And that's why we need to rise up together as one and do everything we can, because if we don't, politically and legislatively, then you're going to have a U.S. federal judge who's going to be making the decisions for us.
Well, let's talk politically for a second here, because you and I have spoken before about the situation at Skid Row, Councilman De Leon. Judge Carter has singled you out in the past in terms of how much you have personally put at stake on helping these people in your district. And we've also talked about how bogged down homelessness finances have become over the years. How much of a political hammer is it for you to have a federal judge focusing his legal muscle on your district?
Well, listen, you know, if the city of Los Angeles is the epicenter for homelessness, then my district that I represent, that I'm honored to represent, City 14, is the epicenter for homelessness nationwide. I want to put this in context for all of our listeners. I have more unhoused individuals in City 14, the district I represent, than the entire homeless population of the city of Chicago in the city of Houston. Those are the third and fourth largest cities in America. I didn't compare apples to apples, a city versus another city. I compared a city council district 14 with the homeless population in its totality in those major cities, Chicago and Houston. So that gives you an idea of the gargantuan, epic challenge that I have in City 14. But I want to give credit where credit's due. A lot of great council members throughout the city of LA have been working hard themselves, and they deserve just as much as credit as I do. You're right. I'm a newbie, if you will. I've been here about 4 months, you know, on the city council, but I have a little experience with tackling, you know, complex
issues. But councilman, your colleagues on the council don't have a federal judge that's backing them up on this. I mean, this is a lot of muscle, in your district.
Well, I tell you one thing right now, it does help without question, but I want to go back to what I said a few moments ago. You know, City 14 is ground zero when it comes to the number of unhoused individuals that currently live there in comparison to the rest of the nation. Also, we've had a historic containment strategy that started back in the 70s with the mayor and city council members who made a political and legal decision to contain unhoused individuals in the Skid Row downtown area east of downtown Los Angeles, between downtown and LA River. Right now, we see what the results have been. It's been disastrous, and not just for our unhoused neighbors and friends, but for the entire city.
That's LA City Councilmember Kevin De Leon. Councilmember, thank you very much for your time.
Hey, you have a great day. Thank you so much.
All right, from downtown Los Angeles, next we're going to head up to Pacoima, where we're going to hear about that neighborhood's fight for environmental justice. That's next when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us.
The LAS Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at las.com/sweeps.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and kpcc.org. I'm E. Martinez. Pacoima is one of the oldest neighborhoods in the northeast San Fernando Valley, surrounded by three freeways and home to an airport, a railway line, and industrial facilities. The predominantly Latino community is one of the most disadvantaged neighborhoods in California in terms of pollution. All week, we're going to be delving into the environmental risks Pacoima still faces today and what's being done about it. It's part of Covering Climate Now, a global collaborative of more than 400 media outlets focusing attention on the climate emergency in the run-up to Earth Day on Thursday. But first, we start with a history lesson. And here to tell us about how Pacoima came to be is Jean-Paul Contreras de Guzman, a history teacher at Windward School and lecturer at UCLA. His forthcoming book project is called A Touch of Danger, Southern California's San Fernando Valley and the Racial Politics of an American Dream. And also joining us is local historian Crystal Jackson. She's president of the Pacoima Historical Society and author of The Entrance, Pacoima's Story. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, Jean-Paul, today residents of Pacoima are predominantly Latino, but that wasn't always the case. Can you walk us through the neighborhood's history when it comes to its demographic makeup and how that's led to the Pacoima we know today?
So, you know, kind of the modern history of Pacoima really begins in the late 1800s when, as you mentioned earlier, the railroad started to come through the East San Fernando Valley. And that is the time period when communities of color, particularly African Americans and Mexican Americans, found employment working on those railroads. And as the San Fernando Valley started to develop through the early 20th century, segregation became more and more hardened, especially after the great water bond issue made so famous in the movie Chinatown that irrigated the San Fernando Valley and turned it into really prime real estate. However, the majority of the valley was off limits to Black, Indigenous, and other people of color, except for Pacoima. And so in the mid-20th century, like kind of leading up to World War II, it became this really fascinating, eclectic neighborhood of African-Americans, Mexican-Americans, and Japanese-Americans, too.
Japanese-Americans? How did Japanese-Americans get into the mix in Pacoima?
That had to do with the agricultural opportunities located in the East San Fernando Valley. And Japanese American farmers were very lucrative and had their own neighborhood and established a variety of institutions that are actually still in Pacoima to this day.
Now, Jean-Paul, how did World War II change Pacoima in terms of its population as well as industries and also employment opportunities?
Oh, it changed it very dramatically. On the one hand, we would see the rise of brand new industries for wartime defense sprout up in places like Burbank. So if people are familiar with the Burbank Empire Center, that used to be a Lockheed plant. And so African-Americans engaged in what historians call the Second Great Migration from the South, finding whole new industrial labor opportunities in places like Lockheed. But again, the only place they could live would be places like Pacoima. Meanwhile, as we know, Japanese-Americans were largely liquidated from their homes, their farms, their businesses in Pacoima and the rest of the San Fernando Valley.
So, Crystal, how did the neighborhood change post-World War II? How did the neighborhood in Pacoima change post-World War II?
Post-World War II was actually the nemesis for bringing in the African-American community to Pacoima. After the war, Los Angeles faced a housing shortage, and they ended up developing homes, which they named after a famous heavyweight boxer, Joe Louis. And that was to attract, it was a dog whistle to have the Caucasians not come to buy in that area. And it was a bullhorn for African-Americans to come both from the South and from Los Angeles to buy these homes in Pacoima. It was so popular that it populated a good section of Pacoima to eventually having 75% of the African-Americans in the general population of Pacoima.
Wow. So, Chris, that's an amazing number, because if someone were to go through Pacoima today, they would not probably think that. Now, today, Pacoima is surrounded by the 5, the 118, and the 210 freeways and is home to a Whiteman Airport, the Valley Generating Station, as well as several landfills, junkyards, and other industrial facilities. Jean-Paul, how and why did the neighborhood become really the site for these freeways and facilities? I remember when my mom and dad moved out of my grandma's house in Koreatown, we moved to Panorama City, which is right next door to Pacoima. And we were wondering why there were so many different kind of industrial facilities all around.
The fact that Pacoima is home to all of these industrial facilities, it abuts all these freeways, that's all by design. Because historically, city planners have basically built those areas deemed undesirable in communities of color. You know, when we go back all the way to the 1930s, an agency called the Homeowners Loan Corporation, a federal agency, deemed the area of Pacoima the lowest grade possible, which was red. And that's why Pacoima is, the people of Pacoima have historically been those people who are excluded and been the victims of redlining.
We're talking about the history of Pacoima with Pacoima Historical Society's President Crystal Jackson, as well as Jean-Paul Contreras de Guzman, history teacher at Wynwood School and lecturer at UCLA. Crystal, can you tell us about the history of pollution in Pacoima and also the San Fernando Valley as a whole? I mean, what specific events shed light on some of the environmental risks the community faces today?
There's been a number of environmental risks in Pacoima. I mean, even today with Whiteman Airport, it's creating a huge discord within the community because Whiteman Airport was established there in 1946. Shortly thereafter, in 1955, they built the projects. And people in Pacoima didn't really realize the impact of jet fuel or anything like that. And me, for one, actually lived across the street from the airport,
oh,
right
wow.
there in the projects for a short period of time. And later on, you find out what the effects of that was. But today, they're actually trying to get the airport taken away from Pacoima because of that. So there's a 50-50 draw split between the community as to whether or not they want that airport to go or stay. But that was one of them. The other one, other huge one, was Hanson Dam, which Hanson Dam was built in 1940 and was the largest earth-filled reservoir in the world at the time it was built. And it was beautiful. They leased acres to the city of Los Angeles, made a recreation park, had all this nice stuff, the lake, boating and hiking and fishing there. And then in the 80s, it dried up, and instead they built another lake, a smaller one where people could fish. And they actually built the largest aquatic center in the country right there at Hanson Dam as a public swimming pool. So they replaced it with some nice stuff, but there is still some construction dumping. So, you know, and then that was like a gem to the neighborhood that was really kind of stolen from them. So there's a lot of issues with that.
Jean-Paul, Pacoima also has a history of activism. So what type of activism has come out of the neighborhood of Pacoima and why?
Pacoima, it's interesting, precisely because it has this really eclectic, multi-ethnic community. It was the hub and the center of so much political activism that usually people associate with perhaps East Los Angeles or South Central. So as early as the 1950s, upwardly mobile African-American professionals who were settling in Pacoima founded the Pacoima branch of the NAACP. African-American professionals worked extremely hard to put pressure on the San Fernando Valley Realty Board, for example. When we fast forward to the 1960s, we see the children of Pacoima attending neighboring San Fernando High School and calling for the same type of equity and justice that we saw in the Chicano blowouts in East Los Angeles. So there were student strikes at San Fernando High, and the young people of Pacoima, particularly the African-American community, had a very close relationship with what was then called San Fernando Valley State College, or CSUN. And when CSUN had their own amazing student rebellion in 1968 and 1969, the community of Pacoima had that connection with them.
And Jean-Paul, when it comes to industries moving out of the San Fernando Valley, wondering if that has any impact or any connection to why there was some activism, because when neighborhoods get decimated by industries leaving, I mean, I got to imagine that that sparks some kind of reaction.
Oh, absolutely. And so when we think about deindustrialization in the 1970s and 1980s and 1990s, that really catalyzed a lot of community organizing to address the poverty that arose due to deindustrialization that also took place at the same time of gutting the social services system. And we would also see in the 1990s and 2000s, activism to really push back at the San Fernando Valley secession movement, which wanted to break the valley away from LA. And it was Pacoima activists who, called a spade and said that this was a form of latter-day white flight to try to depress the power of communities of color in Pacoima and the rest of the East San Fernando Valley.
And Crystal, we've been talking about some of the challenges that Pacoima has had to deal with over the decades, but I gotta imagine the pandemic was a pretty big obstacle.
Yes, this pandemic, COVID-19, has hit Pacoima harder than any other town in the county of Los Angeles. It actually had the highest number at one point. And I think primarily because there's so many people living together in one house, there's multi-generations in one house that has affected it. And it's just snowballing because they have to get to work. They have to go out and make a living and still try to survive. Yet they're in a small, and those houses are small in Pacoima. They're like 900 square feet. And there's a lot of multi-generational families living in one house. So the pandemic has been horrific for Pacoima, to say the least.
What's the state of the community's activism today?
We see activism around particularly immigration issues, given the demographics. As you know, we've been talking about today, so much concern about environmental justice as well.
Well, the activism is like massive in Pacoima because we actually, from grassroots activism, picketing, marching, changing the landscape of some of the police brutality issues, we ended up with two congresspeople from Pacoima, and now we have a U.S. senator from Pacoima. So our activism has been huge. In terms of many issues.
And that's Alex Padilla, the U.S. Senator.
Alex Padilla is our U.S. Senator now. And then we have Barbara Lee, who doesn't live in the Valley anymore. She's from Oakland, but she graduated from San Fernando High School. And then we have U.S. Congressman Tony Cardenas. And then we also have State Assembly Luz Rivas from Pacoima. So we have grown to this huge officials from grassroots to state and national lawmakers, which is so impressive to me for a town like Pacoima.
That's Crystal Jackson, president of the Pacoima Historical Society and author of The Entrance, Pacoima's Story. Also with us, Jean-Paul Contreras de Guzman, history teacher at Windward School and lecturer at UCLA. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And to learn more about Covering Climate Now, you can go to LAS.com to see more of our coverage and hashtag Climate Emergency Week for stories from the U.S. and also around the world. All right, coming up next on Take Two, some breaking news from LAUSD Superintendent Austin Buettner. That's next when Take Two continues.
How to LA is your connection to Los Angeles. Get to know its history.
The 1920s were a huge boom time in Los Angeles, and downtown was just exploding.
Its politics.
It's the biggest local prosecutor's office in the country.
And its food.
Korean spices with like a hint of sweetness.
And just everything we love about LA. Subscribe to How to LA from LA Studios wherever you listen to podcasts.
Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and kpcc.org. I'm E. Martinez. All right, that breaking news, LA Unified School District Superintendent Austin Buettner will step down after his current contract expires at the end of June. Now, he's led the district through a period of unprecedented tumult, and his departure means more transition during a very precarious time. For more on all this, we have KPCC's education reporter Kyle Stokes. Kyle, how unexpected or expected was it that he would not renew?
Well, it certainly is not something that's been a part of the conversation publicly among parents in the school district. But I know that this has been something that from behind the scenes, it's certainly a question I've had. This is a deadline that has been looming in front of school board members. They basically faced a decision in mid-May about whether to renew Buettner's contract, which is expiring in June. And it's kind of been an open secret within the school board that his support on the school board is kind of soft at this point. Buettner was hired in 2018 by a very different coalition of school board members. He was really championed by then school board member Richard Vladovic and four members of sort of an ascendant wing of charter school backed LAUSD board members, members who were backed by charter schools in their campaigns. And since then, a lot of that coalition has sort of felt that Buettner has been a little bit too cozy with United Teachers Los Angeles, particularly through school reopenings. There's also, Vladovic is no longer on the board. So it's not clear how deep Buettner's support was on the school board. And I'm saying all of this about this high politics, despite the fact that Buettner, even from some of these people, we're talking about here, the board members have praised his pandemic response and given him really high marks during that whole process. So was it expected? Was it unexpected? There certainly was a deadline out there, and it wasn't quite a secret that Buettner's support on the school board was a little bit shaky.
One more thing, Kyle, really quick. I mean, this is like the sixth leadership transition in a decade, and it's still unclear what school will be like in the fall. So how much havoc might this wreck on the district?
Well, Buettner, in a letter where he communicated his desire to have his contract expire as planned, said that he hopes that the district can hire from within its own ranks, and he believes that the talent exists within the district's own ranks to replace him. So that's certainly an interesting statement from a man in Buettner who came in basically with a mandate to shake up the status quo, to advocate for a response that says it's time to pick an insider to go for your next superintendent. So I thought that was one interesting statement that stood out to me in the letter where he communicated his desire to have his contract expire.
All right, that's KPCC education reporter Kyle Stokes. Kyle, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
All right, now many parents have been having difficult conversations about racism with their kids since the murder of George Floyd last summer. And these conversations are likely starting up again now that fired Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin was convicted of killing Floyd yesterday. We're going to check back in now with Amber Coleman Mortley, a civics education and parent blogger known as Mom of All Capes, about how to discuss the verdict with kids. Amber, welcome back.
Hi, thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure being with you and so glad to be back.
Now, Amber, just in case listeners don't remember, you're a Black mom raising three kids. So I want to start with your reaction to the verdict yesterday.
Yeah, so there are so many mixed emotions and so many thoughts. It was a very challenging moment for me as a Black woman to process all of this. I do want to say that the general sentiment that most of us agree with the verdict shows how far we've come. I spent a lot of time going back to 1992. In April of 1992, I was around the age of my own kids. So, you know, thinking back to how far we've come as far as a verdict with police brutality back then with the Rodney King trial, and then here we are now with Derek Chauvin's verdict. You know, there is a bit of hope, but it's also mixed feelings, if I may, you know, just be completely honest. Lots of empathy, right? Spending a time deep in empathy for George Floyd's family, for Darnella Frazier and her family. You know, she was the woman, the young woman, teenager who videotaped all of this so that this trial could even happen. So just thinking about all of those things and processing.
And I want to ask you about her in just a bit. Your kids, the three girls, 12, 11, and 9, what have they been saying to you or talking to you about the last few days?
Yeah. So, you know, we try to not watch the trial live. We've picked up clips here and there. I felt like it would have been a bit too traumatic for us to watch each and every time that it was available for viewers to consume that. But we have been discussing, you know, justice, right? This idea of justice unrealized, you know, this charge where all of us, each and every one of us has a responsibility to make sure that we're pushing for justice for all people. So that's how we've centered our discussions. I do want to also just hold in the light that, you know, my daughter, after we, you know, did our podcast episode on this last night, she said, "Mom, you know, another person was killed by the police in Ohio." And I'm like, "What is going on? We just had this verdict." And unfortunately, you know, a 16-year-old girl was killed. So we then talked about, you know, Makia Bryant and like, you know, what does that mean? So even though we have this verdict, even though we're talking about justice, there's still a lot of work to do. And that's kind of how we centered our conversations as a family.
Yeah, that was Columbus, Ohio. An investigation is underway currently, but video clips released shows that she's holding a knife and in some kind of fight. When it comes to police shootings and Black people, I think the focus is mostly on Black men or Black boys. Mm-hmm. You have a daughter, you have three daughters. We mentioned the ages 9, 11, and 12. How is that affected conversations that you're having with your children? Because, you know, the focus has always been males.
Right. You know, the hashtag Say Her Name, you know, if people are not familiar with, you know, all the women who have died, please do some deep reading and deep searching and thinking about these women. You know, Kimberly Crenshaw has an amazing TED talk about intersectionality, and it's rooted in specifically police violence against Black female bodies. That's something that I have a conversation with my kids about, you know, thinking like, okay, of course we have our own personal responsibility that we want to uphold, but we do also need to think about how do we show up in communities? How are we seen as threatening? How are we seen as not non-threatening? You know, what are the ways that we can advocate for others? You know, we feel relatively safe, but that doesn't mean that we'll feel relatively safe in all spaces or be perceived as a relatively safe individual in all spaces.
So you have had that talk that Black parents have with their sons, with your girls.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Wow. Absolutely.
And how does that talk go for you?
You know, I often use the metaphor of Bambi and his mom in the meadow, right? So, you know, thinking about the movie, Disney movie Bambi, where Bambi is like going out in the meadow and he's really excited. And the mom says, you know, you have to be careful out here, right? There's the hunters are out here. For me, I think of, you know, well, I'm Bambi's mom, right? So thinking about how are we cognizant of our surroundings? How are we cognizant of the way that we're perceived? Is it fair that we have to be cognizant of our surroundings and the way that we're perceived? You know, and then how do we find allies to help us reshape the way that we're perceived in society, right? So it's a three-dimensional conversation. It's not a fear-mongering conversation. It's not a victimizing conversation. It's a very empowering discussion about, you know, our relationship to justice, right? And our relationship to our community, right? Because community members call the police, right? So we have to think about how do we strengthen relationships between people so that everyone can feel comfortable.
We're talking to Amber Coleman-Mortley, civics educator and parent blogger, about the Derek Chauvin verdict and discussing it with your children. We mentioned earlier that we know about what happened to George Floyd because a 17-year-old woman videotaped the incident on her phone. What have you told your kids about what you, Amber, would expect out of them if they were to find themselves in a similar situation?
Yeah. You know, I think I hope, you know, we would all hope that none of our kids would have to be in that kind of position, right? You know, I discussed with them that justice is an evolving process of agreements, right? Between people and between people and each other, between people and governing bodies. You know, thinking about, you know, what is my responsibility to my community? You know, for all intents and purposes, like, let's just be honest, Darnella Frazier literally set her own well-being aside to ensure that we understood what was happening in her community, right? It was like citizen reporting times 1,000. And so, you know, for me, my expectation is that my daughters would always uphold justice. They would always, however, understand that their safety is the most important thing as well, right? So, you know, we don't want our kids to just feel like they have to like put on a cape and, you know, be a vigilante and just go out and, you know, bring justice on their own. You know, where are spaces that we can always also bring in allies and other people to stand with us, right? So, and fortunately, for all of us, we were able to stand with Darnella. But, you know, I don't know. I would hope that my kids would never have to be in that position.
It's awful situation to even think of, right, Amber? Because, I mean, getting involved is the reason why what happened yesterday happened. It's because she got involved. But as a parent, I'd want my kid to be as far away from danger as possible. Because getting involved for a white kid with white parents is a lot different than a Black kid with Black parents or a brown kid with brown parents.
Right. Right. Absolutely. Right. And also understanding, you know, that though there are differences in what those expectations look like, right? Like that all of us are empowered to take a stand. I really want to say that, right? That the impetus should not be on people of color to call out injustice. We need white people calling out injustice just as much as we need people of color reporting on what is happening in their community. I would say that our podcast has been this really beautiful year-long journey for us as a family to talk about justice, to talk about civic responsibility, to talk about community and connectedness, to talk about, you know, we cannot continue to silo ourselves and expect change to occur. We have to collaborate. We have to work together. How do I, as a parent, build that capacity in my child, right? I need white parents to do that, and I need people of color's parents to do that as well.
That's Amber Coleman-Mortley, civics educator, parent blogger, on how to talk to your kids about the Derek Chauvin verdict. She tweets at Mom of All Capes and discusses these topics on her podcast, Let's K-12 Better. That's available wherever you get your podcasts, and tonight's episode is all about yesterday's verdict. Amber, as always, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure. Thank you.
More Take Two coming up in 60 seconds. Stay with us.
I'm Julia Paskin, host of Weekend Edition. Join me as I talk with NPR's Sarah McCammon about her new book, The Ex-Evangelicals, Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church. She's not alone in leaving the church. She's found she's among a rising generation fleeing the fold. That's April 25th at the Crawford in Pasadena. Tickets at laist.com/events.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and KPCC.org. I'm Ian Martinez. The Academy Awards are happening this Sunday, but amid a pandemic, what can we expect? Plus, ex-staffers at Abigail Disney's company Level Forward speak up about their time with the company. For this and a lot more, let's go on the lot.
Stick your head out and yell.
You want a chocolate?
All right, Mr. DeMille, I'm ready for my close-up.
Joining us, as always, Rebecca Keegan, senior editor for film for The Hollywood Reporter. Rebecca, welcome back.
Hi.
All right. I know it's a weird kind of Oscars ceremony this Sunday, but it's still the Oscars. I'm very, 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 very excited. You spoke with the producers about their plans for the show. So, Rebecca, what can we expect to see?
Well, this is going to be a very, very different Oscars Sunday, obviously, because of the pandemic. For one thing, most of the show is taking place at Union Station, not where we're used to seeing it, at the Dolby Theater in Hollywood. And they're trying to shoot it more like a movie, according to Steven Soderbergh.
I can't wait.
And less like an award show. Yeah. So expect a big sort of opening that will feel very cinematic. And they want the show to be one that you'll think of years from now and remember, oh, yeah, that was the year that Steven Soderbergh, Stacey Sharon, Jesse Collins produced the Oscars.
I almost think, Rebecca, that whoever designed and built Union Station designed it with movies in mind. I mean, it is very cinematic, that place. It's been in a million movies.
It is. It's beautiful and, you know, a big piece of downtown L.A. Of course, not everybody loves the idea that there is going to be this big production in the midst of a transportation hub, although the producers say they will not interfere with any of the running of the trains. Everything will be able to continue on schedule. But, you know, there are a lot of logistical challenges that go with not only shooting at Union Station, but shooting in the middle of a pandemic. This show will have a lot of the nominees unable to travel. So yeah. The producers have set up venues in Europe in order to accommodate those folks. It's also going to have no host, which we had.
Which I can't stand,
year.
Rebecca, when there's one
you
available
like
right now, right here on this show. Okay, but that's another thing. Go ahead.
You know a host or two. Yeah. And it's got all these very, very serious movies and very, very serious times. So, you know, people like the Oscars, I think, sometimes to be escapist and to be fun. And the producers say it'll be joyous. But nevertheless, it comes out at a very, very serious time.
And one more thing really quick. Sunday's award show will have pre and post ceremony specials, which is pretty unusual. I mean, can you tell us about these specials, the reasoning behind them?
Yes, yeah, some of the reasoning is to be able to keep the telecast itself just 3 hours. The pre-show will have all of the original song nominees performing there as opposed to during the show itself. So if the reason you were going to tune in was to see the song from Eurovision, you're going to watch the pre-show. After the Oscars telecast ends, there will be a post-show, which will have sort of some recaps and will show the winners having their statuettes engraved and feature some interviews as well.
We're talking to Rebecca Keegan of The Hollywood Reporter. Now, speaking of award shows, the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, that's the organization behind the Golden Globes, is even now in more troubled waters, if that's at all possible. The latest being the departure of crisis management expert Judy Smith and diversity inclusion advisor Dr. Sean Harper. Rebecca, I mean, what is going on with the Golden Globes?
Well, I guess, you know, what happened this week is that the fixer, that's Judy Smith, who you mentioned, is saying essentially that the HFPA can't be fixed. It's
wow.
Not good. Now, this all started, as we've talked about, with a February 21st Los Angeles Times article that revealed the organization had zero black members, among other issues. Since then, the sort of controversy has just snowballed. And this week, the LA Times reported that Philip Burke, a past president, forwarded a racist email to his fellow members on Sunday. Since then, NBC, the Globe's broadcasting partner, has forced the organization to expel Burke.
So just to be clear, so this is after all of the controversy from a few months ago, that just happened.
That just happened this week. Yeah, wow. He apparently forwarded that email on Sunday. I mean, and it is not looking good. This is kind of a hot mess when your diversity and inclusion advisor and your crisis PR person jump ship.
The Hollywood Foreign Press is a hot mess. That's a perfect way to say it. Now, okay, Rebecca, you have a story out today about toxic workplace allegations at Abigail Disney's company, Level Forward. You interviewed 15 current and former employees and business partners. What did they have to say?
Well, the former employees described a pattern where if they expressed any disagreement with the CEO of the company, who's Adrian Becker, they would be punished in the form of no longer being invited to meetings or having budget information withheld from them. Many also described working for reduced pay in exchange for things that never materialized, either equity in the company or help getting their own projects off the ground. And they talked about Becker being, you know, ill-equipped for certain conversations around race and culture in the office.
So tell us more about Level Forward and why these particular allegations are really noteworthy.
Well, part of it has to do with who Abigail Disney is. She's a member of the Disney family who's been a vocal critic of the Walt Disney Company for its treatment of workers. And she and Adrian Becker founded Level Forward with the express purpose of adding inclusion to Hollywood and sort of bringing more projects from women and people of color, which they've done. But these allegations are primarily from former employees of theirs who are women of color.
All right. One more thing. Last week, we discussed the closure of ArcLight Cinemas and Pacific Theaters due to the pandemic, losses from the pandemic. You recently spoke with former ArcLight employees about the theaters and what it has meant to them. What did they have to say?
Well, it turns out, as I've learned from talking to these employees, the ArcLight was really kind of a film school for many people who worked there. One woman said, quote, "Everybody viewed this chapter in their life as their Tarantino moment working in the video store."
You know what? Wasn't the New York film school or film university across the street?
Well, there's one in Burbank that I'm aware of. But I think, you know, a lot of these were people who couldn't afford film school, and they came out here and got a job at the ArcLight, and that's how they met people in the industry or people aspiring to be in the industry. Yeah. That's how they watched the Q&As, they worked on their scripts while they were waiting to take tickets, and it really became a different kind of film school for a different kind of person who wanted to work in Hollywood, many of whom have gone on to do so.
I remember seeing a lot of people with those black sweatshirts from that New York Film Academy, I think. I used to see them all the time at the ArcLight, milling around, going to movies. Yeah, they had a lot of opinions about movies, those students.
That's, it doesn't. It's L.A.
Yeah, of course. That's yes. Rebecca Keegan, Senior Editor for Film for The Hollywood Reporter. Rebecca, I'll talk to you next week.
See ya.
All right, if you missed any part of Take Two today, whew, you missed a good one. But you can get it. You can get it again. Just go wherever you get your podcast. There we will be waiting to be heard by you. You can also find us on Twitter. We're at Take Two. That's at Take Two. I'm there as well, at A Martinez LA. A Martinez LA, good for Twitter and Instagram. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two is back tomorrow at 2. Marketplace is next.
Hey. It's Brian, the host of the How to LA podcast. How about we go to the movies? Join us for a 10-part series, Revival House, and discover the magic of LA's indie theaters. Who knows? You might meet someone.
I know it sounds antithetical because you're just sitting passively, but in fact, you're connecting with everyone else around you.
Subscribe to How to LA from LA Studios wherever you listen to podcasts.